Hey.
Hey, it's Rebooting the News with me and Jay Rose, and I'm Dave Weiner, and we have Rich Ziotti with us as a guest here.
Hello.
A very esteemed guest, I might add.
Hello,
man of the
Rich.
Hour. Man of the hour. Yeah. I mean, how does it feel? Rich's software readability, it's taken the world by storm, basically, and now is part of, not bundled with, but actually baked into Safari 5.0.
Right.
Did that surprise you? Did you know that that was coming?
I think it was the weekend before the keynote day. There was a rumor, like something had leaked out. Mm-hmm. There were some bullets about what was going to be in Safari 5, and I read it and I said, "Well, that sounds a lot like readability." And next day, it wasn't part of Jobs' keynote, but I think there was another presentation for Safari 5, and lo and behold, it was there. We were surprised, to answer your question.
Yeah,
definitely.
It's kind of remarkable there hasn't been more discussion about it in the tech blogosphere. I wrote a piece about it on Friday, but I haven't read very much other than, you know, there's been some acknowledgement that it's there.
Yeah.
So we need to talk about what readability does. Why don't we start there? We're just going to dive right into this. Is that okay, Jay?
Sure, but just make sure you give some context and background.
Oh, let me do that first. Right.
Yeah, the context and background.
Well, I like to get right into it. But yeah, the context and background. Just for Rich and for anybody else that's new to the show, the name of this podcast is Rebooting the News. And it started out, basically, I was doing some interviews with people, and I've known Jay now since, 2003? And always been an admirer of his, and he was one of the people I wanted to interview. And so I called him up, and we did an interview, and we there was more to talk about, so we did another one, and did another one, and kept doing it. And then it started becoming sort of like, okay, we should do this, like, a regular day of the week, and eventually, we needed to come up with a name. And the thing that we both agree on is, I think, Jay, you'll correct me if I'm wrong.
I will.
That it's not, when we talk about the news system of the future, people tend to talk about what it will be, okay? And our point is that we're already in it. This is already the world of the future. We're already in that future. And the whole, and it's not just, you know, also a lot of people look at the transformation, they think of, you know, all the pieces staying in place, but what we're saying is that actually it's more like a reboot. It's more like, yeah, there'll be a news system because people, you know, are like news, right? And they use news, they need news, they are news-oriented. We are a news-oriented species, but the way we do news is now and in the future is different from the way we've done it in the past.
Yeah. So. Also, as a student of professional journalism, a professor of journalism, one of the things I learned way back in graduate school was that the way American professionals do journalism was profoundly shaped by the production routines they learned for a given platform. And what happens over time is that demands that are actually an artifact of that platform get transmuted into the nature of journalism. So today, when we have a new platform, we kind of have to go back and rethink what journalism is because so much of it was an artifact of a production routine that isn't the production routine anymore. So for me, that's a lot of what the rebooted system of news is about, is disentangling journalism and news from a particular production platform, printed newspaper, broadcast, right, platform, that it had become confounded with. And this is something that's easier for people outside the profession to do because part of what professional journalists have mastered is precisely those acts of production. That's what they're good at. That's where their knowledge resides. That's where their marketable skill and their prestige lies. And if you're really trying to rethink not journalism, the profession, but news and how people are going to get it and use it and produce it and distribute it, then you have to disentangle news from any particular production platform.
So
that's one of the themes of the show as well.
And that's why this whole thing fits in with rebooting the news, because, you know, one of the rules that we have about thinking about this stuff is not to be too constrained by the way things have always been done, right? And so readability, which I think we'll now get into what it does, sort of challenges all of that, you know? It's kind of turns it upside down, which is why, you know, but the important thing about it is that they're, the users like it, right?
Right.
And so it, and this goes along with what I've been saying lately in the shows that we've been doing, is that you always need to be asking that question, is this something that the users want, and then can we find a way to do it?
Empowering the users is a theme of the show.
Or treating them like customers and saying, if I give them what they want, maybe they'll pay for it, right? Mm. You know, I mean, it's like that's sort of the way it works, right? I bought a computer, I buy a notebook, I buy a pen, I bought a coffee. Not because of some obligation, sense of obligation, well, you know, they have to pay their bills and they have to, you know, have kids who have to go to school and all that. No, I buy it because this is what I want, right? Mm-hmm. And
starting where users start is a principle, I think, that we share.
Yes. Yeah. So that, with that in mind, so does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Okay, good. So readability.
What is it?
What does it do? Yeah.
Very simply, it's a tool that if you're on a page that has some semblance of long-form reading, it doesn't have to be a very long article, but it could be a few paragraphs onward. If you click on it, it'll effectively study the page that's in front of you, pull out the readable text, get rid of everything else, and then presents it in a format that makes it a lot more comfortable for reading. That's effectively what the tool is.
Now, that's harder than it sounds, right? I mean, you're looking at the page. You can see the story sitting there right in front of your eyes.
Right.
But
right.
for a computer, it actually is a little hard to figure out where the story is.
That's right. That's right. When I had coded the first version of readability, and it probably had somewhere between a 75% and 80% success rate. It's pretty tricky to find out where the text is within a particular page. I work at ARC90, and some really talented engineers, smarter than I am, took that algorithm and probably bumped it up to 95%, 97%, depending on. I mean, it's really rare.
I've never seen it fail.
It rarely fails. And when we made that update, that's when the tool really became pretty solid, and people really started to rely on it.
So you have, I mean, your users are enthusiastic about the product, right? This is one of those products that they love, right?
And yep.
Yeah.
Rich, did this product come out of your experience as a user, as a reader?
Good question. Yeah.
That's a great question. Absolutely. I do a lot of reading online. I used to have a couple of different habits in terms of coping with reading online. One was I would print. I would actually print the article out and take it with me on the train, or a handful of articles out. Printing just is obviously more comfortable on the eyes. Another thing I used to do was I'd seek out the print button in the browser, even though I wasn't planning on printing. I knew the print view of that article was going to be a lot more comfortable. So I started messing around, looking for different tools and Firefox add-ons and messing with styles. And then I just said, you know what, let me just try to build something. And I hacked away for probably 4 or 5 weekends and came up with what was the first version.
What was your perception of the unreadability of text on the web? What was the problem you were trying to solve?
It was a couple of things. One was I wanted some consistency. I appreciated the variety that the web brought. But I really wanted, if I'm on a particular kind of monitor, let's say a 23-inch monitor, I'm 2.5 feet away from it, there's a particular font size and a particular form factor that I wanted, regardless of where I was on the web. The other was some sites were just painful to look at. Things were moving around. Vertical ads that kind of affected my peripheral vision. as I was reading, and I just wanted everything to go. I wanted everything to go away. It wasn't how do I strip the ads. That by no means was the goal. It was more just how if I cut and pasted this and put it on paper, what mm-hmm. would it, that's what I would want in my hands. So that was the motivator.
Really. It's striking. I mean, all of the artwork that the, you know, like I tried it with a page on Yahoo Sports, and you know, they throw all this. I mean, no, it's not advertising. It's the look and feel of the site, and you kind of don't even notice it anymore. You know, I mean, it's sort of like the frog boiling in water. You know, yeah. over time, they've just added so much, you yeah. know, color and sparkle to the page that you know, like you didn't even notice it happening. But then you do the A/B comparison, you go, wow, you know, it actually can be a lot easier because the type gets bigger. Mm-hmm. You know, and as you know, guys our age, it's probably not a bad thing. I don't know.
Oh, I used the product. I saw the point. Oh,
okay, good, yeah. good. So, but maybe some people have. We'll put some screenshots up sure. on the site too when we do this. So, okay. So, I think we have kind of a basic idea. Now, Apple, isn't it? It's like.
Well, wait a second. Oh. Wait. Before you get
going
to
too
that.
Fast. Okay, all right.
Going too fast.
I want to get into this though. This yeah, is where it gets really interesting. Okay. Because well, why Apple, right? I mean, you know.
Okay, so yeah. you release this product as what kind of thing?
Oh, there and, you go. That's a good question. Right?
And yep. you made some decisions about how it would get into the world, right?
Yes.
So what were they?
Well, I wanted it to work on as many browsers as possible. At first, when I was thinking about it, I was thinking more in terms of a Firefox extension. But Firefox is, you know, 20-25% of usage out there. So I started coding it in what's called a bookmarklet. And a bookmarklet, I'm a big fan of bookmarklets. They're really, really powerful. They're essentially bookmarks that have code inside of them. And if you drag or install this bookmarklet on your toolbar in the browser, rather than taking you to another page, which is typically what bookmarks do, it would process the page you're looking at. And that allowed it to be installed pretty universally. Internet Explorer, Firefox, all the browsers support readability effectively. And it's very lightweight. There's no install process. There's no heavy lifting that's required to get you going.
And you made it free.
We did make it free.
Why?
Yes. Well, we have something at Arc90 we call the lab, the Arc90 lab. And the Arc90 lab, we're a consulting firm. We actually do have a product, but we're it serves a couple of purposes. One, it's kind of showcases what we're capable of doing at Arc90. And the other is it allows a lot of really talented engineers in the company to scratch an itch. They like to build cool stuff that isn't necessarily coming from a client directive. And everything on the lab to date is free, and 95% of the stuff on the lab is actually under some form of open source license. Readability specifically is under the Apache 2 open source license.
What does that mean, being under the Apache 2 license?
It's really similar. It's really not that different. It's actually probably
different from GPL,
yeah. and Creative Commons. If it's probably, and I may be wrong on this, it's probably the friendliest of all of them in terms of
so all. So what does it say? Basically that you can use it for anything, but you have to give us credit for having done
that's
this.
That's correct. Yeah. It does not require you to put whatever you use it within back out into the open source community or anything like that. It just requires attribution.
Not viral.
It's not.
That's
yeah.
why Apple was able to do what they were able to
that's
do.
Right.
Safari's that's not right. as a whole package. Safari uses WebKit, which is
correct.
Open source, but
correct.
Safari itself is not open source.
That's right.
Now, Rich, when you invented this bookmarklet, you must have realized that stripping out the ads would cause some people to say you're undermining our
yeah.
business here.
Yeah.
So how did you wrestle with that? What was your thinking about that?
Well, I always found some comfort in the fact that the page loads first. It isn't automatically turning it into a readable view. So you're getting that your ad impressions or whatever, that normal process is happening. The other thing I was kind of banking on is that we're small and nobody would really notice.
That didn't work out, did it?
It didn't work out. Funny. The motivator around it was not external in really any significant way. I really badly wanted this tool. And, you know, I became addicted to our own tool. In terms of the implications, I'd given them some thought, but I just always assumed it would kind of stay under the radar. And besides, it wasn't outright. I mean, there are tools out there. If someone really wanted to block ads right out of the gate and never see them,
well, they do have all kinds of ad blockers.
Absolutely, exactly.
But it gets much. Now, can I go into this whole thing? Okay, yeah. So now, okay, it gets really interesting. Right. So you have to understand Apple is this company that's very involved with the publishing industry, the same way that they've been very involved with the music industry and are getting involved with the TV industry.
Yeah.
Right. So now this is their new front, right, is publishing.
One of their new fronts.
Right. And they're, constantly in meetings with all the major publications and whatnot. And what's their pitch? Their pitch is, come bring your content into this very predictable, safe environment called the iPad, right? Or the iOS, actually. It now has a new name. They've changed the name of the software. It now has a name. It didn't have one before. The reason why is that it's the same software running on iPhone, on the iPod Touch.
iOS stands for what?
I don't know. Something operating system, obviously.
Uh-huh.
They put the I in front of things like iTunes, iOS.
iOS, well,
it would be the thing that comes, the OS that comes from Apple. So here you've got, on the one hand, they're trying to usher these people in, right, to that, right? The same people now now you'd have to ask that question that you asked Rich. Now, Rich is just, the CEO, is that right, of a consulting company? You're the CEO, right, Rich?
Correct.
Right. So Rich is the CEO of a small New York consulting company. Wouldn't it be nice if you had Steve Jobs sitting here so you could ask him, Steve, did you ever think about the ads that these guys might be putting on their stuff? And I think we'd have to say that his answer, if he answered honestly, which would be hard to imagine, would be a little different from Rich's.
Yeah.
In other words, it wasn't just a scratch and itch of his, right?
Right.
This was much more substantial. It was, and it makes your mind spin, right? And if you're a guy like me or Rich, it makes your mind spin in some ways that may not be so bad for publishers, right? That's the interesting thing is that, and this is sort of, sometimes the first step down the road, this goes to an analogy I once used about how in football, when the quarterback gets the ball, the first thing the quarterback does is takes five steps back, right? And you might look at that and say, geez, he's running the wrong way.
He's
why is
retreating.
He doing that, right?
Yeah.
Well, what he's doing is buying himself a little room so he can see what the field looks like and a little bit of time, letting his defensive line do their job, right? And now he can see what's going on. Maybe he can throw a pass or the running back comes around, he gives him the ball, he's got a place to go. The publishing industry doesn't really do this, okay? But Rich may have inadvertently done this for them. Because now the question comes up, okay, you've got this wonderful, predictable environment sitting there in the iPad, and it really looks enticing.
A more readable environment.
Ah, isn't that interesting? None of this crap, you can't put all that crap in there. Mm-hmm. Or maybe you can, but they're going to really, because they have this wonderful thing that says, if we don't like your product, it doesn't get in the store, right? Mm-hmm. So they have some say in what you put out
cleared
there.
Cleared of distractions.
Uh-huh. Well, maybe we could do the same thing for the web without all of the constraints that Apple's putting on it, right? What are the constraints Apple puts on it? Well, there are a lot of them. And probably the two most important...
Oh, I see where you're going.
Yeah, you see where we're going with this? This is why this is so incredibly interesting, right? Why Jay's giggling because, Jay's a smart guy. He gets this stuff, right? Is that, It's not got the control issue, right? and it doesn't have the tariff. Apple gets a big cut of everything that goes through their store. So if you charge a buck for something,
wouldn't you want that 30% back, Mr. Publisher?
Maybe it's more like 40, I think.
Whatever, yeah.
Whatever it is, it's a big cut. And but the other one is the say-so. The control thing is a real serious problem for the publishing industry. It really is.
Sure.
So
I think another really important facet of the typical iPhone or iPad app that isn't thought too much about, at least today, is the sort of accessibility, shareability, linkability of this stuff.
Right.
It's from what I've seen so far, and it's still really early, these sort of packaged magazines are incredibly static.
Right. Right.
If I'm in the middle of an article in my Time magazine app, in terms of sharing out, they'll add things like post to Twitter and stuff like that, but the web is from the ground up is designed to to facilitate that. Right. And I think you lose a lot
me suspicious of the way the publishing industry, the magazine industry, has gone about its iPad applications so far is that you seem to detect a desire to get rid of the web or to detach the product from the rest of the web.
Yeah.
Because it has advantages, though. You see, that's the thing. Joe Hewitt, who is a brilliant developer, one of the guys who did Firefox. There were two lead developers of Firefox initially. And Joe now is a developer at Facebook. He's done the iPhone and apps for Facebook. And Joe said something, wrote something. He's very outspoken, tends to be very straight. He wrote something a short while ago where he said, this is an impossible trade-off. He, on the one hand, wants the high-level programming environment that the iPad or the iOS offers. And I'm struggling with this right now in the blogging software that I'm doing because of, all of the different hoops you have to jump through just to make a page look decent with cascading style sheets. It's ridiculous. All I want is to throw some headlines up on the page, have them be expandable, and be able to put some subtext under it, a byline, a few little ornaments on it, whatever. This problem has been visited thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of times, yet when I start with that problem, I start at no higher level than anybody that's ever come before me. So Joe looks at the situation on the web and says, why shouldn't we have a high-level environment that doesn't come with all the tariffs? In other words, he wants what they call the programming environment on the iPad is called Cocoa. Okay, what he wants is Cocoa without the controls and without the tariff. Very reasonable, isn't it? And when you look at the history of software development, okay, we basically had this in the 80s, right? But we threw it out. We threw it out because we liked the freedom of the web. We liked the fact that because the web had something that those desktop GUI environments did not have, which was networking. So we had this choice, either beautiful or networking. Now we're looking 20 years later, and Apple has finally given you networking and beautiful, okay? Right? Well, we still want networking and beautiful, but we don't want to be locked into Apple's trunk, right? And I'm sure that Steve Jobs, again, if Steve Jobs were sitting here, I don't think he would dispute the fact that, number one, we could do it. Number two, that he's helping us do it is irrefutable. Irrefutable that he's making it easier for us to do this.
With the Safari move, you mean?
No, by setting an example, by showing us how to do it.
Uh-huh.
By making the closed version of this, he's creating demand for the open version.
What do you think, Rich?
Yeah, I think he's right. I think the word that kind of resonates for me is, the fact that people are taking the iPad and iPhone platform so seriously is that they've sort of written off the web as this messy place. That it's a place where the economics at play almost have sort of laid down ground rules that don't allow for beautiful experiences on the web. There's such enormous pressure to monetize through advertising that the end user experience, the reading experience, has been forced to give way. And if we all throw our hands up and say, well, you know, that's how the web works, then yeah, there will people will go elsewhere for what we'll call better experiences. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, what's also worth noting here is that based on what we've heard just on a pretty much a daily basis around from readability is people are so emotional and passionate about this need. And when you see that, and this is something that we had no expectation around, when you see that, there's probably a lot of money to be had. Also, the fact that people are buying these apps on the iPad. They're paying money because they want that better experience.
Hold on. When you say they're emotional and passionate about this experience, what are the emotions that are coming out? What is this passion?
I mean, it's the response is usually overflowing with, "You've changed my life." The web is, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but these are actual emails we've gotten. You know, I'm never going to look at the web the same way again. Another thing that's arisen is the people with cognitive difficulties, people with vision problems, people who use screen readers. People have thanked us, asked us how they can give us money. It's been, you know, it's really resonating with people. It's something, again, we didn't expect when this thing went out. But it was something that, it was one of those rare needs that people assumed these were the rules, mm-hmm. and they didn't even bother articulating until mm-hmm. a tool came along that showed them a better way.
Gotcha. I have to ask Dave a question. Yeah. When you said high-level programming environment, I don't know what that means. What is that?
Well, first, I just want to amplify what he's saying. It's like anybody that's ever had a product like that knows exactly what he's talking about. You know, the Tumblr guys, for example, I'm sure they get overwhelmed with that kind of stuff. In other words, the computers have a unique ability to help you realize your potential. They really do. It sounds all airy-fairy and, you know, whatever, but they actually do have that ability.
Oh, I know that.
Right. Yeah. I know you understand that. Yeah, but
I understand the emotions.
The cynics, involved. Right. Yeah. The cynics. I've had products like that, and, you know, I've had fan base. You know, it doesn't always make you the most money, and, in fact, we made a lot more money when we figured out how to appeal to the larger group of people that don't feel that way about products.
I remember when I met Mena Atrat at who's one of the founders of Six Apart,
right.
At the first Blog Her, which was the first gathering of women bloggers, which an amazing event. I was like one of three men there. It was an incredible thing. And I just went up to her to thank her, and I remember because I was using movable type to do my blog, which I still do. I was actually overcome with emotion when I met her because I knew that I would be unable to express to her what her invention meant to me. So I just ended up saying some banal things about
you know, she hears it all the time.
I'm sure she does.
Or she
totally
was at that time. Because
she knew what I was trying to say. Right. Anyway, go on.
So for high level, I mean, programming environments, and I'm glad I got a chance to sort of gather my thoughts a little bit about this, that they're built in layers, okay? So, you know, it's kind of a lot like the way the brain evolved. You know, you've got layers of intelligence in the human intellect. You know, your lowest level functions are actually at the base of your spine. And then as you move up and move north, you get to higher level function. You know, so at the base of your head, you've got, you know, more sophisticated functionality. And then you go all the way to the front of the brain. That's kind of where your consciousness is, right? Well, software is the same way. And so you have at the core of, let's say, you know, this Macintosh, for example, at the core of it, underneath all, I have a Macintosh in front of me, I should mention, because people can't see that. At the core of it, there's a Unix kernel, a scheduler that was written probably in the 1970s and hasn't been touched since. I mean, maybe I'm exaggerating. You know, maybe this one was written in the 80s, but it wasn't written last week. I can promise you that. And on top of that, there's a whole bunch of, you know, there's C libraries that are connecting up at a different level. So they're doing memory management. So they take the memory of the computer and they apportion it so that applications can get little bits of it. Then next layer up, there's some software that manages scroll bars, and there's software that manages the mouse, right? And then once they had the mouse working and the scroll bars in the Windows, they could get to, you know, now Windows have content inside of them. They have spreadsheets or they have word processing documents, right? So the development of software has been this sort of like layering on top of the work of other people, right? And then every once in a while, layers get thrown out and huge amounts of work are lost. And it doesn't happen often, but when it does, and it happened in like the early 90s, where we switched from the graphic operating systems of Windows and Apple Macintosh to Unix server side, you know, and because they had the networking so much better. So they've added very little functionality. As you know, I mean, I use the iPad and it's nice and everything, but I wouldn't say that it had the same chin dropping effect, you know, for me as a user that using the Macintosh had in 1984. I mean, that was a very special experience. I remember that, you know. I'll remember the first time I saw a Macintosh, and I'll never forget. If I haven't forgotten it yet, I probably never will forget it, right? This wasn't quite the same. I don't think of a single lick that the iPad does that I actually haven't seen before. But Joe is right. It we want that experience to live in a greater context than just you know, and of course Apple probably has some patents in there and they're probably not going to like it when this stuff, but we can make little incremental improvements and those will be absolutely revolutionary if we can get agreement. If we can, now the question is, and how do you actually do that? And I actually think I know how to do that. So
to summarize, the reason you got so excited when you saw this readability button on Safari 5.
I didn't get excited when I saw that. I got excited when I met Rich.
Okay.
Right. I got excited because this is a guy with a strong mind, and he thinks clearly. I don't want to, like, you know, I don't want to embarrass you or anything, but I'm probably doing it anyway. He thinks clearly, and he's not scared. You know, in a lot of places, guys like in his position would go, oh, I don't think I want to go there. I don't think I want to talk about that. That's dangerous, blah, blah, blah. You know,
the reason you got excited when you met Rich is the possibility that we could have the same calm and clean and fresh and new environment.
Right.
For reading that the iPad is promising some developers,
right.
But still on the web with all its networking capacity,
right.
That we wouldn't have to lose the horizontal connections to every other page and all the other users on the web, but we could
We call it rebooting the news. We don't call it, so it's the bootstrap idea, right? We don't call it getting in Apple's trunk and letting them have the key, the news.
Or re-gardening the news.
Right. And, And now if you can see, like, the context was, I was already thinking about this stuff more than just thinking about it. I was actively developing it. If you look to see what's happening on Scripting News.
What is happening on Scripting News?
About a month ago, I started a complete rewrite of the software behind it. And the goal of that rewrite was to drastically simplify the back end.
To get away from the cascading style sheet, you're saying?
No, I'm going right into the cascading style sheet.
Simplify it.
I'm going to take on all the, I'm going to embrace it. I don't care. I'm not fighting it. I'm using it.
Okay.
But what I want is, I want a simpler, easier, cleaner, yet more powerful. I want more power, but I want it to be simpler. And that's usually not possible. Usually you have the trade-off in there, right? You have more power, it gets more complicated. But what happens is, after you've lived with something for enough time, right, which in this case I've used this software for a long time, for like 10 or 15 years, right? And And I've also used WordPress, and I've also used Tumblr, and I basically tried everything because I sort of said, I don't want to write blogging software anymore. I'm done with that, okay? That was a few years ago. But, you know, these guys aren't moving, honestly, and I think they've done it wrong. I've written about this recently, is that WordPress has this idea that you have to go to a dashboard to edit content. And that's just plain wrong. I can see going to a dashboard for all kinds of other things, for setting preferences, but not for editing the stuff that I'm writing. We had that much better, working much better with our blogging tools in the early part of the last decade, right? We had that working much better. And they didn't. I asked Matt Mullenweg, who's the lead guy on WordPress, if he ever looked at Radio or Manila, and he said no. So I knew that he hadn't. He was honest enough to say that he hadn't. And, you know, so we threw a lot out there because a new generation came along and they didn't bother to look, right? So I'm still here and I'm looking around. I'm going, this is wrong. This was supposed to be simple. So, all right, so I can see how to make it simpler and at the same time give you functionality you didn't have before, right? Mm-hmm. And so, but I'm going to do this all by myself. Oh, geez, you know, it's like that's going to be really hard, right? So then along comes Rich, and here's a guy I can play tennis with, right? On the one side, I can only do so much with the environment. I don't know JavaScript that well. I'm lost in cascading style sheets. Mm-hmm. What I know is back-end server-side programming and content editing tools. This I know better than the combination of those two. I think I know better than as well as anybody else does, if not better. Because I think there are still things that these young guys have not figured out yet. You know, the Joe Hewitts, the Matt Mullenwegs, the Tumblr guys, so forth. I think there are things they don't know. But when it comes to JavaScript and CSS and stuff, I'm a complete novice. Now, I can understand the concepts that I want. I know what I want, but I can't actually make it, okay? And so, and I also know that if you have somebody to play with, you know, that's a good way to bootstrap. That way, he represents one side of the equation, which is the runtime environment. He is thinking on its behalf. I represent the other side, which is the authoring, the people who are creating the material that's then going to be read in that environment. I represent the reporters and the production people at the news organizations and so forth. And once we finish our work or get to some place, starting place, we can then show our results to the people in the news industry and say, here, this is something you might want to do that is an alternative to what Apple's asking you to do.
Okay, so yeah. Why is a new readability tool that strips the article out of its messy context online not necessarily a threat to the economics of the news industry?
You want to take that one, or should I? I'm happy to take it.
You can go.
Yeah, okay. It's what I said before about the quarterback. You know, let's take a couple of steps back. Let's look and see how the field looks. Let's try to understand it from the point of view of the person who's waiting to catch that ball down there. You know, let's start thinking about...
Okay, so I take my five steps back.
Yeah, well, let's
I
start thinking
what?
About how we can deliver a great experience to that person. See, you're never going to get money out of people when you're treating them that way. Okay? Or you may squeeze some money out of them. It's like this company that's suing on behalf of the Hurt Locker. You know, they're going to go extort money out of these. Okay, some of them are going to give them money. Do you think they're going to love them? You think they're going to line up to watch the next movie that the Hurt Locker people make? I think they're going to curse the Hurt Locker people for doing this, okay? Much better would be to have them feel about about the publishing industry, the way they feel about his product. In other words, God, you're listening to me. You're mm-hmm. giving me what I wanted. Mm-hmm. You're making my life better. Mm-hmm. What a relief that would be, wouldn't it? Plus, you know, it's like, can you come to work in the morning and get excited about ruining the news? Or can you come to work excited about delivering a new, powerful way to use the news? I know which one I would rather do.
I gotcha.
Right. Yeah, if I could just add one thing, Rich. To that. You know, I think perception is a big part of this. I mean, if I had, you know, one of the analogies I like to use is, you know, if I had come to someone with a business plan 15 years ago and said, you know, I want to open little shops all over New York City and charge $3 for coffee. And it's well known that box coffee, box cart coffee is 75 cents. I mean, Starbucks coffee is probably a little bit better than boxcar coffee, but is it five times better?
Hmm.
And I think what's at play here is the experience around the thing. That people have shown time and time again that they really value a better experience around the thing. Mm-hmm. I think Dave hit it on the head in terms of, I'm not here for the waiter, I'm here for the food.
Mm.
And I think what's happened on the web is they've sort of fallen down a slippery slope where the economics are forcing them to really stop thinking about or are unable to think about the end user and the reader. And on top of that, it doesn't seem to be panning out for them. I still hear that newspapers are struggling. And
even with all the clutter.
Even with all the stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, is it time to sort of step back and say, okay, wait a minute. People are telling us they want to pay for a better experience. Or they want to, you know, it's the beginning at least of a better relationship with your readers. Then, you know, how do we untangle that and try something different?
Okay, so I want to try to give a 50,000-foot view of this discussion as I listen to it. One of the things that really concerns me about the present moment, and the iPad is part of it, is that we stand in danger of losing something that's incredibly valuable and powerful about news. And that is the very idea of our best journalists communicating with the largest possible public. To me, that is a very good thing and a very important thing. So, for example, when the journalists at the New York Times discovered sometime early in this century that they had 20 times more readers online that they ever had for the printed newspaper, 20 times more.
Wow. This when did they realize that? When was that?
Sometime 2003, 2004.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. This was incredibly powerful because it means you're addressing a public way bigger than you had before. And the fact that that larger public could reach New York Times quality journalism for free was undoubtedly a big reason for that.
Mm-hmm.
The alternative to a system where our best journalists communicate with the biggest possible public is what you see in the $5,000 a year oil industry newsletter, where rich people who have the money can pay directly for the costs for people to assemble very high quality and very recent information. And part of the reason they're willing to pay $5,000 a year for the oil industry newsletter is precisely that other competitors don't have that information. And so part of the value of the information is the fact that lots of people don't get it. The idea of journalism as a force for good in a democratic society is the opposite of that. It's everybody who has a stake in the news should be able to grab a piece of the news and get the news that they need. And I understand the collapse of the business model in journalism. I understand the incredible devastation being wrought this moment by people losing their jobs by the trimming down and cutting back. And that's huge. But if we can't solve this problem, if we can't keep the idea of the best journalism going to the broadest possible public, we're going to fall back into a situation where the people who have the money and the means and the power are very well informed, and everybody else gets American Idol and crappy, busy, cluttered, shitty news.
The users have to learn how to communicate to these people, and they have to learn how to start listening. That's the challenge here, because they're not cluing into something that those of us in technology who've been lucky enough to have hit products already know perfectly well. That if you hit that vein, if you hit that sweet spot, you don't have any trouble with money. Money isn't your problem. Okay? And so the challenge is, the reason why I get excited about the news is because I know that sweet spot is there. And I'm looking for it. And I know you don't get there by seeing it as a problem to solve. If you're looking for a solution to a problem, you never find that spot. However, if you're looking for a way to excite and delight people, and you yourself are excitable, then eventually you get rich. It just seems to be the way it works. I know that the cynics don't like to hear that, but and they think that the world doesn't work that way. But the world actually does. We're out of time. It was a great show, guys.
Readability expert Rich, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Good night.
Bye.